Welcome back. Hour two of Issues Etc. We've got Pastor Matt Harrison with us. We'll be listening to some PBS News Weekly roundtable on 2006 and what lies ahead, according to some reporters who should know. And then we'll be talking with Marianne Hackett of Illinois Right to Life about Illinois pro-life legislation in 2006. The last hour is a sermon review of Robert Schuller's. It's not his last sermon, but it is his last sermon, almost his last sermon, as the only senior pastor of the Crystal Cathedral. We'll hear it. We'll review it in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Pastor Matt Harrison is our guest for the next few minutes. He's executive director of LCMS World Relief. He joins us to talk about tsunami relief. It's been over a year since the tsunami struck, and 2005, much of it, when it comes to relief agencies, was taken up with continuing the relief efforts there in so many countries all around the Indian Ocean. Pastor Matt Harrison, welcome back.
Greetings, Todd. It's always great to be with you.
Before we talk about the tsunamis, let's talk about the story that's in the news today, and that is the doubly tragic story of, as far as I know, last count, 12 miners dead, made more tragic so because of a miscommunication saying that they'd survived the explosion in this mine. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, my thoughts and prayers go out to the poor families of these working men, salt of the earth. Because of the intensity of the schedule coming upon us just after a little holiday break, I wasn't sleeping well last night, so I got back up out of bed about 11:30 or so to turn the TV on and sat there for a while and watched the wonderful news, and everybody was euphoric, and then went to bed and woke up this morning only to tell my wife that what had happened, what I thought happened, and then turned on Fox News and found out exactly the opposite was the case. It was just a small, tiny piece of the kind of pain that these poor people are suffering there, and they certainly are in our prayers and thoughts today.
It seems like so long ago. 2005 was a very busy year for you because it was a year, at least it seems, of more natural disasters worldwide than usual, but it was all kicked off day after Christmas 2004 with the tsunamis. Tell us about what you remember immediately after that.
Well, this has been an extremely difficult year for people who are involved in disaster response, and it has been, I think, the tsunami and then particularly Katrina, because of our proximity, even in St. Louis, but our proximity and the fact that we had 40 or 50 churches directly affected and heavily affected, caused enormous challenges for this office here and our people. I don't know. I think a lot of people talk about donor fatigue. I think that's largely an urban myth. We're finding that our donors are responding and continuing to respond tremendously right through our busy season for receipts, and that's December. So the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and our other donors have been very, very generous and continue to be so. I think, though, there is the factor of caregiver fatigue, which is a real one and has been a challenge for this office, a challenge for me personally. And a little piece of it was sitting in the same easy chair. We went to my wife's folks' place up in Springfield over the New Year's break, and sitting in the same easy chair, I began to see the news clippings of what had transpired as I sat in that same easy chair a year ago for the anniversary of tsunami, and I simply had to shut it off. I still can't watch the events on the news without just feeling utterly troubled. The events transpired, and then within about 8 or 9 days after the event, I was on the ground in Sri Lanka and beheld the utter and unbelievable devastation and destruction, which included a trip south of the capital of Sri Lanka to a place called Colombo, and or from Colombo south about 60, 70 miles, and there saw the wreck, the deluge of the train which ran along the coast, the train called the Queen of the Sea. And that train ran at that point about probably a quarter or a third of a mile away from the coast. It was unfortunately in a very low spot, and the wave had come in there. And everybody, after the first wave, fled to the top of the train, and there were probably 1,000 people on the train. And then the second and larger wave came at 35 or 40 feet and swept the train right off and into a suburb and swept many, many people away. And I was there while recovery was still going on. So these events remain rather fixed in my own mind and rather indelibly placed there. I'm praying, I sincerely am praying that the Lord would be merciful this year and the number of tragedies and difficulties would be reduced, but I know it's all within the mystery of His will and plan and purpose, and so that's what we do.
What kind of progress has been made? I mean, everyone that I've talked to has seen it firsthand. Of course, the news can only do a little bit of justice to the picture there, but everyone who talks about it, even a year afterwards, says there's been progress made, but it is still going to be decades before anything is back to any semblance of normal. What kind of progress have you seen?
Well, that is true. I was back in South India and then also visited Indonesia, Nias, and some other places in May of this past year. And at that time in South India, I went through camps where people had been living since January, had been living in plastic sheets covering makeshift poles, black plastic. And at that time, it was a good 110 degrees in South India. And here folks were living in these black plastic makeshift dwellings that were literally on top of each other, hundreds in a row. The challenge in so many of these places, although tremendous amounts of money have been spent, what's happened now in Aceh, for instance, is where you originally had probably 100 or 150 relief agencies there, the numbers drop to a dozen or so significant or really agencies that are still on the ground doing things. And the progress is simply, it is correct, progress is going to take a long time. You've got a huge amount of money flowing. The United States committed nearly $1 billion alone. And just to create the kind of infrastructure that can handle those kind of funds, let alone the nonprofit funds, is an enormous task in and of itself.
I last heard that the money collected from individuals, corporations, things like that, beyond what the U.S. government pledged to give, that private money dwarfs the public money.
I've heard those similar reports, but I don't know any in numbers, and I would not doubt that that's true.
There are, you know, a lot of problems that money can solve, but then there are problems so big that no matter how much money you're carrying around in your pocket, even that doesn't help. What are the most immediate needs of those who are still suffering the victims of that tsunami?
Well, there continue to be reconstruction needs and just simply putting the infrastructure in place to rebuild, education needs, the immediate crisis phase has long been over, but still people continue to be displaced. There are literally hundreds of programs which are employing individuals in various creative ways, and those needs continue. But I think the most significant needs that will continue for some time are going to be housing, education, and also, we think, especially Christian counseling and care for people who have suffered these tragic events. The kind of trauma, and I often reflect on this, just sort of having my finger on my own pulse as we go through these traumatic events. They are traumatic for people like myself who does not even experience them in any real way personally, other than simply seeing the suffering, not necessarily having family members affected, etc. And so the kind of potential lifelong trauma that is involved is something that has to be dealt with in the best possible way, and we believe in the best possible way, connected closely with the gospel of Christ.
Give us a picture of that, if you would. What have you seen of this message persisting through the great suffering and the tragedy and the loss and the destruction that the tsunamis brought, the message of Christ and Him crucified for sinners?
Well, we made a very intentional... We work in several different ways. Lutheran World Relief Baltimore is a traditional partner and works with many other non-governmental organizations to accomplish good goals in education, etc. LWR Baltimore is not, however, a mission organization. That is, its mandate is not to proclaim the gospel. We also, therefore, participate with a number of LCMS, Lutheran Missouri Synod entities in the area, and we have provided assistance to Orphan Grain Train. We've provided assistance to Lutheran Hour Ministries and their ministries on the ground in Thailand and Sri Lanka and other places. They've provided material goods, counseling, Christian care, the whole gamut of needs, all tied together with the gospel. We're continuing to work toward housing, if possible, in Sri Lanka, although it remains challenging. One of the greatest difficulties in working internationally, particularly in Asia, but other parts of the world, is you have some countries which are notoriously difficult to work in, and also notoriously corrupt, and it becomes a complex challenge to spend donor dollars wisely for the best to best ends. And by God's grace, we've been able to wind our way through the challenges, and our partners, our Lutheran partners there, including Lutheran Church Canada, which has several missions in southern Thailand, provided really natural places for us to do work. And so in conjunction with building boats for fishermen and any number of other projects for children, the gospel has always been front and center in those efforts and will continue to be so. We're really proud of that.
We talked about the amount of money that's been given, that's been raised. It is very good news to reflect upon that at the end of a year where the tsunamis dominated. But does the need, that kind of basic financial pocketbook need, continue?
Clearly so. I mean, the staggering level of need and the relative small size of Christian communities in Asia means that the need, the dollars, are always going to be needed and always helpful. A challenge that we face is that during such heavy years of disaster, and we've had unbelievable giving for disaster, record giving for disaster, is the disasters then, which are very emotional, and rightly so, the disasters tend to take away giving from ongoing programs and all the other important work, so we kind of scramble to meet ongoing commitments in Lithuania and Latvia and Kenya and South Africa and Central America, et cetera, et cetera. But, the Lord provides, and He provides amazing people to care and to provide their dollars for assistance for other people, and we're thankful for that.
Matt, we had a conversation with Oz Guinness a couple days back, and he said something quite profound, and I would like you to reflect upon it, if you would. We were talking about being a Christian in an age of suffering, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about Luther's theology of the cross, and he said something several times in that conversation. He said, no other God has wounds, and one cannot go so deep that Christ has not gone deeper still.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of it?
Oh, as I traveled to Sri Lanka, I came across a group of very well-meaning Protestant people who were telling me they had just come from Sri Lanka, and the best way to evangelize was to tell people that, see, they believed in the wrong God, and if they would have believed in Christ, this wouldn't have happened to them. And I just felt sick when I heard that. But a couple hours later, I was standing on the shores of tsunami-devastated Sri Lanka. A small Sri Lankan woman came up to me, weeping and crying and showing me what was left of her home, as did literally hundreds and thousands of people all along the coast whose homes were completely devastated. I mean, brick homes, and I saw the same thing, by the way, in Waveland, Mississippi, same phenomena. Homes that had been literally washed clean off their cement foundation. Washed clean, everything gone. Nothing but a slab remaining of what had been their entire earthly possessions and existence. She came to me and told of how a son had been caught in the deluge, a handicapped son who was still alive, had been severely injured, and was hospitalized. And she was weeping. And in those kind of moments, which by no means are uncommon, I know that I believe in a God who partakes of our human flesh, who joins us, who suffers for us in our stead, so that we know God is not, in fact, no matter what happens, we know God is not angry with us. And we can say with Job, though he slay me, I will yet hope in him. And I could tell Sri Lankan after Sri Lankan, I don't know what God's doing here, but I know he loves you in Jesus Christ. And then work to demonstrate that love by providing aid and assistance. And I think Oz Guinness is onto something. I tell you, enough with this theology of glory, and I see all kinds of it. I see American evangelical preachers on TVs all over India, everywhere I go around the world. Enough with it. Come to the Kibera slum in Nairobi. Come to tsunami-devastated areas. Meet the AIDS children, children with HIV, children whose parents are deceased. Come dwell with the suffering Christ and learn about your blessings and learn about a God who suffers with us and for us and finds meaning in our suffering. I guess that'd be my response.
Folks, when you see the need in 2006, when you read or watch or hear about a natural disaster in this coming year, I want you to think of and to remember LCMS World Relief. Their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. The need continues. Think of LCMS World Relief, bringing concern for both body and soul, Christ-centered and cross-focused. You can also find them at our webpage. Their logo is there on our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Pastor Matt Harrison is Executive Director of LCMS World Relief.
Hey, Todd, yeah. I'm headed to Central America here in a few weeks, and then a little later in the year, heading to South Africa and Kenya, and perhaps we can talk from those locales. But moreover, I think your listeners would greatly enjoy knowing that you have accompanied me someplace in the far-flung world, and maybe we can do some broadcasting from very far-flung places via satellite. What do you think?
I would love to work that out, but you're going to have to work it out for me, Matt. You're the Globetrotter.
We'll do that.
I'd be happy to do it. Very right. happy to do it. Can I bring Jeff along?
No chance.
Good call. Matt, thank you very much.
Yeah, the Lord be with you.
And with you as well. All right, the remainder of this hour, that got a little chuckle out of Jeff. Always does. The remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking, hearing, and then talking a little bit about a very interesting roundtable that PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly had. Some well-known reporters talking about what's coming up in 2006, especially as it pertains to issues religious. Now, PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly Roundtable consisted of the anchor, that's Bob Abernathy. You always hear him when we play these things on the air. There's E.J. Dionne, well-known columnist for The Washington Post. Kim Lawton, who's the managing editor of Religion and Ethics News Weekly. And Barbara Bradley Haggerty, who is religion correspondent for National Public Radio. We begin with Ms. Haggerty talking about the president's appeal, President George W. Bush's appeal with American evangelicals.
If you look at the president's poll numbers, or if you look at the poll numbers vis-a-vis Iraq, you look at evangelicals, 70% of evangelicals still support our being in Iraq, whereas 43% of non-evangelicals support it. So what that means is that the president's entire base of support comes from evangelicals, and I think we're beginning to see him having a more sensitive ear toward evangelicals. We saw that with the case of Harriet Myers. When evangelicals said, we don't want her to be the next Supreme Court justice, he backed off, which is very unusual for this president. He's a stubborn man, and he backed
Barbara,
off.
Although, ironically, they are so loyal to the president that she also, among the only supporters she had on the conservative side, were evangelicals, which just, I think, underscores your point of how strong a constituency this is for the president.
And, Barbara, abortion. It's in the courts. It's before the Supreme Court. What's happening?
Well, I think there is pretty much a consensus that Roe v. Wade will remain intact. I think there's a national consensus about that.
It's a right.
I think pretty much everyone, both in the public and I think it's pretty firm within the Supreme Court, at least the majority of the Supreme Court. The really interesting question will be if Judge Alito is confirmed, how he will rule on certain kind of ancillary issues like parental notification. Actually, he can't rule on that one unless they rehear the argument. But say late-term abortion, that will come up eventually before the U.S. Supreme Court. How will he rule on these issues? So I think that there is, for the first time in a long time, a real kind of question mark over whether Roe v. Wade can kind of be pecked to death around the edges.
And one thing I found really interesting this past year, which I think is going to carry over in the new year, is the extent to which the grassroots conversation is shifting a little bit. And even people who are supporters of abortion rights are talking about maybe, you know, the concession, maybe there can be some restrictions or maybe there are some instances and maybe there should be more focus on preventing abortions. And so there's more conversation going on than there has been.
All right, we're going to pick that up on the other side of the break. We're hearing a roundtable from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. They're talking about the prospect of religious issues in 2006, the first one they discussed there after they came off their conversation on the president's evangelical support, especially with regard to the war in Iraq, is abortion. Very interesting. Barbara Bradley Haggerty from NPR says, for the first time in a long time, she says, there's a real question mark over whether Roe v. Wade can be pecked to death around the edges. And she's talking, of course, about the president's most recent nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Samuel Alito. Now, that doesn't change the balance of the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito's entrance in the U.S. Supreme Court keeps the numbers on Roe exactly where they were before. It's a wash after you have... you might have a stronger voice than Sandra Day O'Connor, but you've got Robertson for Rehnquist and then Alito for Sandra Day O'Connor. But Sandra Day O'Connor was a swing vote on a lot of these issues. Well, does it shift it just enough that the kind of legislation we've been talking so much about on the program, the kind of legislation that doesn't go directly at Roe but gets at abortion around the edges, regulates abortion... Well, does it change it enough to make that shift? We'll hear more from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly and your comments after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Well, I'm glad Jesus didn't feel that way about you.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, responding to the idea that the AIDS crisis is self-inflicted and Christians need not respond in love.
Look, you reap what you sow. You're a sinner. You're damned to hell. Go rot. That's not Jesus. And the Bible doesn't tell us, Jesus says, you made your bed, now lie in it. I'm not going to help. So it's an impossible response for a Christian. Even though we know that actions have consequences, but consequences, those consequences don't kill mercy and don't kill a proclamation of the law in order to bring the gospel.
Find LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org, Christ-centered, cross-focused, love for the neighbor.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Senate Judiciary Committee will begin confirmation hearings next week for Supreme Court nominee Sam Alito. Senators are expected to make the Planned Parenthood versus Casey suit the centerpiece of their questioning. What is the Casey case and why is it so important? Terry Phillips explains.
As a federal appeals court judge, Sam Alito voted to require women seeking an abortion to notify their husbands. And that decision, the Casey decision, went to the Supreme Court redefining abortion rights, according to Brian Failing of the Center for Law and Policy.
It introduced the undue burden test. In other words, states can regulate abortions, but they cannot do so in such a fashion as to create an undue burden for a woman.
Jay Sekulow of the American Center for Law and Justice says Alito's vote in Casey is a rallying point for pro-abortion forces.
I think they're going to try to use the abortion issue as a wedge issue with regard to the Alito nomination, but it did not work in the John Roberts situation when he was nominated for Chief Justice, and he had written some very significant legal memorandums questioning the validity of Roe versus Wade.
Sekulow predicts that if Alito is approved, his addition might well change the balance on the Supreme Court in at least some abortion-related cases.
You've got the partial birth abortion case that's at the court right now. They may well hear it. If they do, I think we now carry it 5-4 because Justice O'Connor ruled against us previously. She was the swing vote. I think Judge Alito would vote for us. I think it's going to be significant. It's not the fifth vote for Roe versus Wade, but it does affect a whole host of issues.
Although the Casey decision affirmed a woman's legal right to an abortion, it opened the door for states to put restrictions on abortion. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
In the years since Casey, state lawmakers have enacted nearly 500 regulations that restrict the concept of abortion on demand. Judge Alito could face a full Senate vote before the end of January. For Family News and Focus.
Mornings on AM 850 KFUO offer you a Christian way to start your weekday. Hi, I'm Paul Clayton, inviting you to hear your inspirational Christian favorites, great guests, and the information you need to prepare you for the road ahead. And after the morning show at 9:30, stick around for Focus on the Family on AM 850 KFUO.
Here's what Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Angus Manoj has to say about our book of the month for January. Quote, for C.S. Lewis, true education is a way to free our thinking from the spirit of the age and to humble our ego to objective truth, unquote. The book is titled Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. It's our Issues Etc. book of the month for January. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Irrigating Deserts.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Halfway through the program here, we are just a few minutes into a recent PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly program. They had a roundtable of several reporters. There's Bob Abernathy, who's the anchor there. There's E.J. Dion, who is rather famous for his columns in the Washington Post, nationally syndicated. Kim Lawton is a managing editor there at PBS of Religion and Ethics News Weekly. And Barbara Bradley Haggerty is the religion correspondent for National Public Radio. They're talking about religion issues for 2006. I want to know what you think about it. The first point that's been made is that in 2006, there might be a chance of chipping away, not really threatening Roe v. Wade, but chipping away at Roe v. Wade, especially with the slight change that takes place in the Supreme Court, ideologically, moving from Sandra Day O'Connor to, if he's confirmed, Judge Samuel Alito. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We pick up where we left off. Here is Bob Abernathy, the anchor and the moderator of this roundtable, going on to another subject, and that is the change of leadership going on in certain religious communities.
Barbara, let me move on to something else. There seems to be a change of leadership going on in the religious communities, at least in the Protestant communities.
I would agree with that. I think we may have seen Billy Graham's Last Crusade in New York City. We see televangelists like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell aging. Some people are a bit disaffected by Pat Robertson, you know, calling for the assassination of the Venezuelan president. I think we see people not listening to the televangelists as much as they used to. And what we're seeing is kind of an emergence of a new type of leader. They tend to be megachurch leaders. Rick Warren at Saddleback Church, who's the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, is one. There are several others who are, they have a softer edge to them. They aren't waging the culture wars quite as much kind of rhetorical fervor. Politics is not everything for them. They're very interested in their community. And so I think this is what we're going to be seeing. It's a more democratic, with the small d, system that we're seeing.
And mentioning Rick Warren, I'm really going to be watching this coming year. His new bold initiative to work on Africa and third world countries on issues like AIDS, illiteracy, poverty, all of those more social issues. Yes, he still wants to, you know, spread the gospel, but for him that includes dealing with AIDS.
All right, before we go on, they've raised the question of, and this surprised me a little bit when I was listening the first time, Rick Warren, the next Pat Robertson? That's, I mean, that's not what they're saying. It wouldn't be Rick Warren taking the mantle from Pat Robertson, but the same kind of political slash social influence wielded by the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons during the and Billy Graham to a different, in a different way, through the last decades. Now, at least these reporters are seeing that influence passing to someone else, away from the Robertsons and the Grahams to the likes of Rick Warren. Softer, gentler approach, kinder, gentler approach, less rhetoric, less overt politics. That's true in Rick Warren's case. And a far more global approach. Now, you may not know it, but Rick Warren has been for the last 5 years or so pursuing what he calls a global peace plan. And it's a phase, it's actually phase three of his whole purpose agenda. It's purpose-driven life is the individual, purpose-driven church. A family that is a 40 days of community is the next level. And then it goes up to the society. And key to that is this global peace plan. One of the things you have to laud him for is that he is doing really yeoman's work when it comes to bringing attention to the worldwide AIDS crisis, Rick Warren is. A very different kind of leadership of American evangelicals than they're used to in the past. At the same time, I had to think about this, but at the same time, you have a Rick Warren who kind of has broader, less political, more global, more deeds, not creeds, kind of an approach to his leadership of American evangelicals, you still have Ted Haggard, who's the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, who in a recent, the Barbara Walters thing on heaven, we didn't have a chance to play this for you, but there was a whole 2-3-4 minute segment in that special where they were featuring the evangelicals and Ted Haggard, where they talked about how Ted Haggard actively campaigned for George W. Bush in 2004 in his church on Sunday morning. He said, I did it. I actively campaigned for the president on Sunday morning. Now, that's more of the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell style. So I think you have, if it is a transition, it's going to be slower than it looks according to these, because no matter how you cut it, he still is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. If he is emblematic of what evangelicals are or still are, maybe the age of Robertson and the age of Falwell is not entirely over. We return to PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly, still on the issue of Rick Warren.
I think there's a sense by Rick Warren and others that evangelicals have been a little bit inward-looking. They've thought too much about their own needs, their own, quote, felt needs, and that it's time for them to look beyond the boundaries of the United States and really help people.
That was one of the things that was so interesting about the aftermath of Katrina, that it was these evangelical groups who had, many had the reputation of not caring for others perhaps as much as they did, and we all saw that they were the leaders in what was done.
And I think that's the important thing about Rick Warren's ministry and others like him. By the way, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's book sales. Rick Warren sold about 24 million books. And it's a kind of, it's not necessarily that folks become liberals or even moderates, but there is a kind of exhaustion with a hyper-politicization of the church that I think Rick Warren represents. And he speaks for a lot of, you know, fundamentally conservative but evangelicals, but also who are moderate in spirit.
All right, before we leave that subject, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you see the days of the Pat Robertsons, the Jerry Falwells waning, and the days or even of the Ted Haggards, waning, and the days of the Rick Warrens on the rise. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I found it quite interesting that here's the line. Let's see. It's E.J. Dionne, say, and I think that the important thing about Rick Warren's ministry and others like him is not necessarily that folks have become liberals or even moderates, but that there's a kind of exhaustion with hyper-politicization of the church, and I think that Warren represents, and he speaks for a lot of fundamentally conservative evangelicals who are also modern in spirit. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think that there's any fundamental conflict between being caring about global issues, the worldwide AIDS crisis, and all the things that are in Rick Warren's peace plan, and good, sound, conservative theology. I don't think there's any conflict at all. But I think Dionne is wrong. Now, they certainly, American evangelicals certainly have not become political and social liberals or moderates. I say that again. I don't think that American evangelicals have become political or social liberals or moderates. But when it comes to their theology, beyond just kind of a bare affirmation that the Bible is God's word and that Jesus is somehow the Son of God, there's not a lot of theology there. And theologically, it looks a lot more like classic liberalism. Theologically. I wrote an article about this some months back. Bible-believing liberals. People who are, sometimes even unbeknownst to themselves, politically, socially, morally conservative, theologically liberal. But they think of themselves as conservatives both politically and theologically because they just don't make the distinction. So I disagree with E.J. Dionne there. Next subject they take up in this PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly Roundtable is the Episcopal Church in the United States of America. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Is the Episcopal Church in the United States of America going to come apart in this coming year?
This coming year is a huge watershed moment for the church, I think. They're meeting for their general convention. They're electing a new presiding bishop. And the issue of homosexuality and the larger issues of interpretation of scripture and who has authority for the church, all of that is going to come to the fore this coming year. I don't think there's going to be a huge rip that's immediate, but it's the slow tear has been going on and will just continue. And this year will be key for that.
I am kind of anxious to see what that means. I think she knows a little bit more than the rest of us do about what's coming in the Anglican Communion. And in particular, with the Episcopal Church USA, the question is, well, the tear has already taken place between the Episcopal Church USA and the Anglican Communion. That took place very shortly after the elevation of Gene Robinson as the first actively homosexual bishop in that church. So that took place some time back. What she's talking about is the further disintegration of the Episcopal Church USA itself. Now, there's already been a fair amount of disintegration, and we're already talking about a church body that, along with the other mainline Protestant denominations in the United States, and I'm talking here about the liberal Protestant denominations, have suffered, you know, on the average, roughly speaking, about 30% losses in the last 30 years. 1% a year, boom, 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 they're declining. Real numbers, not just failing to grow, but really, truly, 1% a year dropping, dropping, dropping in their actual membership. And some of those that used to be the biggest are now not even top 10. So the Episcopal Church already was dealt a body blow after the Gene Robertson elevation by its reproof from the Anglican Communion, and then a fairly large exodus of congregations from the church, from that denomination itself. And she says in the general convention that's coming up in 2006 for the Episcopal Church USA, they're electing a new presiding bishop, Frank Griswold, who has been on both sides of the fence when it comes to homosexual clergy and homosexual marriage, who, when he is in America, lays hands on Gene Robinson to consecrate him as a bishop, and when he's in Lambeth, votes with the majority to denounce such actions? Well, he's out and someone else will be in. Very interesting. I'm glad she raised that subject. A final question from Bob Abernathy.
Let me ask each of you to think a little bit out loud about something that you think might be going on in this coming year that you really want to keep an eye on, that you think all the rest of us ought to be keeping an eye on, too. Who wants to start? Kim?
We talked a lot about the polarization between the religious right and the religious left. I'm interested in the ways they're coming together. There seem to be new coalitions happening on things like global poverty, AIDS, Darfur. Faith-based groups are the only ones really paying attention there. And I'm going to be watching that this year.
Ironically, or whatever the word is, that's exactly what I was going to talk about, because Alan Hertzky wrote a very interesting book called Freeing God's Children. And it's about these very unusual coalitions across divides on issues such as human rights, Darfur, sex trafficking, but the broader perspective of human rights. And again, I think there is this hunger on the part of a lot of religious people across these divides to keep some of the polarization of the larger society, political polarization, to keep that at bay.
Barbara?
Well, because I like to get myself in trouble, I think I'm going to continue to watch the intelligent design debate. This is an issue that's not going to go away because people feel so strongly and with deep religious or secular roots to their feelings. It's not going to go away, and I think we're going to be seeing it playing out in the courts and in communities across the country.
Many thanks to all of you. To E.J. Dion of The Washington Post, Barbara Bradley Haggerty of National Public Radio, and Kim Lawton.
All right, I'm a little gratified that the NPR religion correspondent agrees with me. Yesterday we talked about the top 10 religious stories in 2005, and I said that story of intelligent design versus Darwinism will be a bigger story next year than it was this year, and it's a big story already. It'll be a bigger story next year. Well, that's what she said. She's going to keep her eye on that. The other two, talking about what I would call cooperation in externals. That sounds kind of technical, doesn't it? The people who are politically and theologically very, very different, agreeing to work together, the religious right, the religious left, the differences there politically are greater than the ones theologically, by the way. Agreeing to work together in external things, not getting together for theological convocations, not worshiping together, but agreeing to work together on things like AIDS and things like human rights. That's good stuff. Helping those who were persecuted in Darfur, trying to end sex trafficking. That's good stuff. There should be that kind of cooperation. I hope those stories emerge. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Jerry in South County. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Todd. Do you have nice holy days?
Yes.
Great. Okay. What brings to mind the emerging churches, I guess, would be called Rick Warren-type churches. And then you have your anti-biblical homosexual rights of the clergy in some churches. These churches, they're deviating from the theology that's really contained in the Bible. If these people would pay closer attention to what the Old New Testament says, you know, what the Word of God actually says, we could all work together.
Jerry, thank you for the call. I think I know what Jerry's saying when she talks about Rick Warren being part of the emerging church. Now, let's just be careful so we don't get our terms mixed up. The emerging or the emergent church is something very, very different from what Rick Warren is all about at Saddleback. It's a reaction to things like what Rick Warren is doing out there. Not an altogether salutary reaction to that. But, okay, that cleared up. I think her basic point is right. Whether it is the Rick Warrens, their secret sensitivity, their let's have a reformation of deeds, not creeds, of behavior, not beliefs, or the far-left liberal churches saying exactly the same thing, but pursuing things like a homosexual agenda in the clergy and in marriage and things like that, they have one root. These deviations have one root. These errors have one root, and she's right. That is disregard for God's word. So the point is well taken. Thank you very much, Jerry. Last 10 minutes of the program we're going to spend with Mary Ann Hackett. Last 10 minutes of this hour, I'm sorry. The program is far from over. Mary Ann Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. We're going to talk, as we did earlier today, about the pro-life legislation that may lie ahead in 2006 for Illinoisans. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Mary Ann, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Can you give us a rundown of the agenda, such as it is, Illinois for 2006?
I think they probably will try informed consent again because it was only one vote short of getting it out of committee last year. And then the other thing, there are efforts to, on both sides of the aisle, to reverse the governor's mandate forcing pharmacists to dispense the morning after pill against their conscience. And that would be a great victory, I think, for Illinois because the governor has actually denied the rights of people to follow their own conscience by demanding that the pharmacists, and some of the pharmacists have actually been fired for refusing to. So that would be a great victory. Another thing that I think is very good news is a number of pro-life, pro-family groups have gotten together and put together a candidate survey, one candidate survey, which covers the whole range of pro-life, pro-family issues, and that survey will be sent to all of the candidates for office rather than one group sending one and another group sending one. This is one survey, and I think when the candidates see it, that comes from several groups, that they'll be more inclined to fill that out. And when they get single ones, they'll say, well, I've already filled out the one that goes to all the groups. Then the final results will be posted on the Internet, and different groups can use those that apply to their own special issues. So that, to me, is a great step forward.
So better information when it comes election time on what the prospective candidates, the incumbents and otherwise,
right,
really believe on the issues.
That's right, and a whole range of family issues. It'll cover not only abortion and euthanasia and the morning after pill, it covers marriage, family life, rights of families to direct the education of their children, vouchers. It's a whole range of issues, and all of the conservative, pro-life, pro-family groups are working on these different issues, and they can select the issues that apply to their mission and present it to their members.
Let's work our way backwards there. We've talked recently with one of the pharmacists who was suspended without pay from Walgreens in Illinois following after the governor's mandate that you mentioned that pharmacies should be providing the morning after pill. He didn't say anything about pharmacists, and there's lawsuits to kind of clear up that language. But what would it take to overturn Blagojevich's mandate from April 2004?
Well, I think that some of it depends on the interpretation of the health providers in Illinois, which have already a conscience clause, and they've tried to exclude pharmacists from that role. The ruling that Blagojevich handed down is that if the drugstore, the pharmacy, carries the morning after pill, then the pharmacists have to dispense it. Apparently, the pharmacy has the right to not carry the morning after pill or not carry all types of medication. But if they carry it, then the pharmacists are required to dispense it. Apparently, that's the essence of the ruling.
So this is an edict that he issued, kind of an ad hoc kind of a thing back in April of last year. How do you undo something like that?
Well,
Beyond clarifying the issue, how do you undo it?
Well, first of all, he issued the ruling, the executive order, and then it was confirmed by a committee. I forget the name of the committee, but they confirmed the order, and it became essentially the law in Illinois or the direction that these people have to follow. But what has been what has been introduced, and the wording I think is pretty much the same from both the Democrat and Republican side, is that it applies the right of conscience to the pharmacists, that they are considered health care providers, and their job should not be in jeopardy if they decline to do something that it's similar to me, I think, in requiring, you know, the European Union is trying to require all doctors to provide abortion without, and they won't allow any conscience clause. They say the some rights are preferred to other rights, and one of them is to have an abortion. So I think this is another thing, another similar thing, is because the morning after pill acts as an abortion. And I think that's the contention with a lot of the pharmacists, that why they refuse to dispense it.
Informed consent was the first thing you mentioned there, and you also mentioned that it failed by only one vote in committee.
Right.
What are its real prospects in Illinois? That is so crucial, especially when it comes to this phenomenon of people bringing minor children across state lines to Illinois for abortion.
Well, now, that has to do with parental consent. Informed consent really means informing the woman of all the risk. And, you know, there's more and more coming. There were just recent studies from Sweden of the terrible depression that women suffer after an abortion. There's all sorts of adverse things, and the idea is that women it doesn't take away their choice to give them information. They need to have the information to make an informed choice. But the other issue that you mentioned was parental notice, and there's been some positive things going on in that. Joe Burkett has had on his website a number of times and is passing out petitions to the Supreme Court of Illinois asking them to write the directions. You know, we passed an parental notice law several years ago, but the Supreme Court simply refused to write the regulations that would implement it and put it into practice. And so the petitions have been circulating to ask the Supreme Court to fulfill their duty to write the regulations. So if they do that, then Illinois will no longer be a dumping ground for abortions from all around us, because the other states all have parental notification laws.
IllinoisRightToLife.org is the website for Illinois Right to Life.
Right.
IllinoisRightToLife.org. And Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. Thanks
right.
for your time here, Mary.
I was happy to be with you.
Well, tomorrow on the program, we are going to be discussing national pro-life legislation with a representative of National Right to Life. That's coming up tomorrow on the program. Now, when we come back from this break, the last hour is one of the longer sermons I've heard Robert Schuller ever preach, usually because television is a matter of keeping things short and sweet. His sermons run, you know, maybe 10, 11 minutes. This one, almost 18 minutes. Why? Well, there's a reason. It is one of the last sermons, maybe even the last sermon he is going to preach at the Crystal Cathedral as its senior pastor. His son, Robert Schuller Jr., has been voted in by the leadership of that congregation as its new senior pastor. The elder Robert Schuller stepping down as senior pastor. He'll continue to occupy the pulpit now and again and work in a team fashion with his son, but the church belongs to Junior now. When we come back, we'll hear what Senior has to say in his sermon from New Year's Day. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.